In Franklin, Dev lightly rear-ends Priya's car at low speed, a fender bender, the kind of bump that leaves most drivers with a stiff neck for a day. But Priya has a rare bone disorder, and that minor jolt shatters several vertebrae. Surgery, months of rehabilitation. Dev says he should pay for the stiff neck a normal driver would have had. How much does he actually owe? All of it. Every dollar of the surgery, the rehabilitation, and Priya's pain. Because every tort question is really two questions. Did the defendant commit a tort? And then, so what? Damages is the so what, and it is where nearly every negligence problem finally lands. Two halves, four stops. First, the three families of damages: compensatory, punitive, and nominal. Second, the doctrines that stretch or shrink the number: the thin skull rule, mitigation, and the collateral source rule. Third, the limits: the American rule on fees and statutory caps. Fourth, apportionment: who pays when several wrongdoers caused one injury? Start with the animating idea. Tort damages are meant to make the plaintiff whole. The law cannot unbreak a leg, so it does the next best thing. It converts the loss into money that puts the plaintiff, as nearly as possible, where they would have been had the tort never happened. That single idea explains everything else. Compensatory damages restore actual losses. Punitive damages punish. Nominal damages mark a wrong that caused no measurable loss. Three families. Only one of them is about making you whole. Compensatory damages divide into two buckets, and telling them apart is the first move on almost every injury question. Special damages, also called economic, come with a receipt. Medical bills past and future, lost earning capacity, property damage. General damages, also called non-economic, are the losses no receipt captures. Pain and suffering, emotional distress, loss of enjoyment of life, disfigurement. Why does the label matter? Because the rules that shrink recovery, statutory caps especially, target the non-economic bucket and leave the economic bucket alone. We will come back to that. Try one. A broken leg. Hospital bills. The wages lost during 3 months away from work. The physical pain. And the cost of repairing a damaged bicycle. Which of those is non-economic? Only the pain. One item catches people out. Lost earning capacity is recoverable even by someone with no job at all, a full-time student, a homemaker. It measures the reduction in what they can earn going forward, not the paychecks they happen to be collecting. Loss of consortium gets its own paragraph, because it belongs to a different person. When someone is seriously hurt, their spouse loses something real too: companionship, affection, household services, the intimate relationship. The spouse sues in their own name, and many states extend the claim to parents and children. But it is derivative. It rides on the injured person's claim. So if the injured spouse was 30% at fault, or signed a valid release, that same reduction flows straight through to the consortium claim. A separate recovery, never an independent one. Three measurement rules recur. Reasonable certainty, meaning damages need not be proven to the penny, but cannot be speculative. Present value, because a dollar today is worth more than a dollar in 20 years. And single recovery, one lump sum covering past and reasonably certain future harm. You generally cannot come back in 10 years because the injury turned out worse than predicted. One bite. Now, the rule the exam loves, and it takes us back to Priya. Under the eggshell skull rule, also called the thin skull rule, the defendant takes the plaintiff as they find them. The restatement, third, of torts states it at section 31, where a pre-existing condition makes the harm greater or different than would ordinarily be expected, the defendant is liable for all of it. Be precise about what this rule does. It governs the extent of damages once liability is established. It never manufactures liability where an element is missing. And it makes the defendant pay only for the aggravation he caused, not for a pre-existing condition that was already there. So, a plaintiff with a degenerative spine disease that was always going to need surgery? The defendant pays for accelerating it, not for the disease.
The flip side of full recovery is the duty to mitigate, also called avoidable consequences. A plaintiff cannot recover for harm they reasonably could have avoided after the tort. Refuse a simple, low-risk treatment. Let the wound get infected, and the extra harm is on you. Two clarifications keep you out of trouble. Mitigation reduces damages. It is never a complete defense. And do not confuse it with comparative negligence. Comparative fault looks at the plaintiff's carelessness in causing the accident. Mitigation looks at the plaintiff's conduct after the injury, before and after. The standard is reasonableness. A plaintiff need not undergo dangerous, major, or deeply objectionable procedures. Decline a risky surgery with an uncertain chance of success, and you have mitigated just fine. And the defendant bears the burden of proving otherwise. One more doctrine shapes the size of the check: the collateral source rule. Traditionally, damages are not reduced because the plaintiff was reimbursed from a source independent of the defendant. Health insurance, disability benefits, sick pay, a gift. Evidence of those payments is kept from the jury. The wrongdoer should not get a discount because the plaintiff had the foresight to buy insurance. Two modern wrinkles. Many states have modified or abolished the rule by statute, especially in medical malpractice cases. And the plaintiff's insurer often has a right of subrogation. Punitive damages, also called exemplary damages, are the exception to the make-whole principle. They compensate nobody. They punish bad conduct and deter it. So the trigger is high. Ordinary negligence never supports them. The plaintiff must show malice, intent to harm, fraud, or conduct so willful, wanton, or reckless that it shows conscious disregard for others' safety. Two more requirements. Many states raise the burden of proof on that mental state to clear and convincing evidence. And in most jurisdictions, punitive damages must ride on an underlying award of actual, or at least nominal, damages. They cannot stand alone. Then the constitutional ceiling. The Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment makes a grossly excessive punitive award unconstitutional. Three guideposts. Reprehensibility of the conduct, the single most important factor. The ratio between the punitive award and the actual harm, and the gap between that award and the penalties authorized for comparable misconduct. The headline is the ratio. Few awards exceeding a single-digit ratio between punitive and compensatory damages will satisfy due process. And where the compensatory award is already very large, a ratio close to 1-to-1 may mark the outer limit. Two further limits. A jury may not punish a defendant for harm caused to non-parties who are not before the court. And wealth alone cannot justify an otherwise excessive award. Nominal damages next. A token sum, classically $1, awarded when the plaintiff proves a tort but proves no actual loss. Their availability tracks a simple line. Torts actionable per se, complete without any proof of harm, support them. Trespass to land, battery, assault. Negligence does not. Actual harm is an element of the negligence claim itself, so a plaintiff who proves no harm has no claim at all. Not a $1 claim. No claim. Who pays the lawyers? The default is the American rule. Each party bears its own attorney's fees, win or lose. Even a plaintiff who wins a clear negligence case normally cannot add the legal bill to the judgment. The exceptions are real. A fee-shifting statute, a contract providing for fees, the common fund doctrine, and sanctions for bad faith litigation. Finally, caps. Legislatures sometimes limit recovery outright, and the usual target is non-economic damages. Back to Priya. Suppose the Franklin Medical Injury Compensation Act caps non-economic damages at $500,000 and leaves economic damages uncapped. A jury awards her $900,000 in medical expenses and lost income, and $1.2 million for pain and suffering. Work it. The economic award stands in full. The non-economic award drops to the cap. Total recovery, $1.4 million. Read which bucket the cap touches. That is the whole skill. Now the second half. Not what can be recovered, but who pays when more than one wrongdoer caused the injury. Ask first whether the harm is divisible or indivisible. If two defendants caused separate, identifiable harms, one broke an arm, the other dented a car, each pays only for what it caused. The hard case is the indivisible injury. One harm that cannot sensibly be split among its causes. There, the traditional rule is joint and several liability. Each defendant is liable for the entire harm, and the plaintiff may enforce the whole judgment against any one of them. Usually the one who can pay. The plaintiff gets a single satisfaction, never two. And here is the point of the whole doctrine. If one defendant is broke, that risk falls on the other defendants, not on the innocent plaintiff. That rule has eroded. When comparative fault spread and juries began assigning percentages, states asked why a defendant found 10% at fault should pay 100% of the judgment because a co-defendant went bankrupt. The result is a patchwork. Some keep pure joint and several. Many switched to several liability where each pays only its own share. Others adopted hybrids. The Restatement Third of Torts on Apportionment of Liability lays out five separate tracks and pointedly takes no position because there is no majority rule. So know what joint and several liability means? Know many states have narrowed it, and apply whatever rule the question hands you. Here is what a provided rule looks like. The Franklin Apportionment of Liability Act makes all defendants jointly and severally liable for economic damages, but severally liable for non-economic damages, each only up to its own percentage of fault. Joint for economic, several for non-economic, a common real-world hybrid. Two cleanup doctrines finish the topic. Contribution evens things up among defendants. One that pays more than its proportionate share can sue the others to recover the excess. The modern majority divides by percentage of fault. An older approach splits pro rata by headcount. Three limits show up on exams. Intentional tortfeasors generally cannot get contribution. A defendant who settles in good faith is usually discharged from contribution claims. And there is no contribution from a party who was immune from liability to the plaintiff. Indemnity is contribution's all-or-nothing cousin. Instead of splitting by percentages, it shifts the entire loss. Three classic triggers. Vicarious liability, where an employer liable only through respondeat superior recovers fully from the employee who did the wrong. The product supply chain, where a faultless retailer passes the whole loss up to the manufacturer, and express contractual indemnity. Contribution divides. Indemnity shifts all of it. A word on authorities, because this episode named no cases, and that was deliberate. Next-gen questions here rarely ask you to recite a damages rule by name. They drop you into a fact pattern and ask what is recoverable, how much, or who ultimately pays. Nobody is going to ask you for a case name. If you keep only three, keep these. Section 31 of the Restatement, because the thin skull rule decides the size of more fact patterns than anything else here. The Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, because it is the only real ceiling on a punitive award. And joint and several liability, because it is the rule the exam most expects you to know unaided. Now the traps the examiners set. 1. Awarding nominal damages in a negligence case. No harm means no claim, not a $1 verdict. 2. Reaching for punitive damages on ordinary negligence. They need malice or willful, wanton, reckless conduct. 3. Forgetting the due process ceiling. A punitive award many multiples above the compensatory damages is constitutionally suspect. 4. Confusing the duty to mitigate with comparative negligence. Post-injury conduct against fault in causing the accident. 5. Using the thin skull rule to create liability. It only extends the extent of damages once liability already exists. 6. Assuming the winner recovers attorney's fees. The American rule says each side pays its own. 7. Deducting the plaintiff's insurance from the award in a traditional collateral source jurisdiction. 8. Treating joint and several liability as universal. Many states now use several or hybrid liability, and the question may supply the rule. 9. Mixing up contribution, a share among joint tortfeasors, with indemnity, the whole loss by relationship or contract.
Time for the quick check, and this one comes straight from the Bargo Question Bank.
A pedestrian is seriously and indivisibly injured in a chain reaction crash caused by two negligent drivers. A jury sets her damages at $1 million, assigning 80% of the fault to the first driver and 20% to the second. This jurisdiction follows joint and several liability, and the pedestrian was not at fault. The second driver is fully insured. The first has nothing. How much may the pedestrian collect from the solvent second driver? Option 1. The full $1 million because each defendant is liable for the entire indivisible harm. Option 2. Only $200,000, his 20% share of the fault. Option 3. Only $500,000, the loss divided equally. Pause here if you want a moment. The answer is option 1. Under joint and several liability, each defendant who causes a single indivisible injury is liable for the entire harm. The plaintiff may enforce the whole judgment against any one of them, so she collects the full $1 million despite his 20% share. Option 2 applies several liability, limiting each defendant to his own percentage. A real rule in many states, just not this one. Option 3 invents an equal division untethered from the jury's findings. Both would leave an innocent plaintiff short, because the more culpable defendant is broke, which is exactly what joint and several liability prevents. The second driver's remedy is contribution. There are 30-plus more questions on this topic alone, each with every option explained like that. 5 things to take away. 1. Compensatory damages split into economic losses with a receipt and non-economic losses without one, and caps target the second bucket. 2. The thin skull rule makes the defendant pay the full unforeseeable extent of the harm, but only the aggravation, and only once liability exists. 3. Mitigation reduces damages for harm the plaintiff could reasonably have avoided after the injury. It is not comparative fault, which looks at causing the accident, and the collateral source rule stops the defendant taking credit for the plaintiff's own insurance. 4. Punitive damages need an aggravated mental state, an underlying award to ride on, and a ratio that survives due process. 5. For an indivisible injury,
joint and several liability makes any one defendant liable for the whole, with contribution to even things up and indemnity to shift the loss entirely. Which brings us back to Priya and to Dev, who still cannot believe a fender bender cost him a spinal surgery. The law took his victim as he found her, that is, the last stop in torts. Practice this topic with more than 2,900 exam-style questions, free to start, at nextgenbargo.com. This episode is for education and exam preparation only, not legal advice, and we are not affiliated with or endorsed by the NCBE or any bar examining authority.